I'll start with a little background on the title and the topic. So, as some of you know, 2 years ago, I served as the chairman of the governing body commission of the entire International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And I'll tell you, it was an experience. It was such an enlivening experience that I was thinking all devotees in our society should at least 1 year have the opportunity to be the chairman of our whole society. Because it was such a delightful learning experience. Filled with challenges that were way up here, and I'm way down here, and how to do all this. And one of the things that happened that year was the disaster in Haiti. So here's what my thoughts were. I was thinking, we're an international spiritual organization. We need to do something. But I'm not used to thinking about what we need to do. I'm just riding in the train, and somebody's the conductor and somebody's the navigator. And I just ride in the train, like the rest of us, just go along for the ride. Somebody else is thinking about it. But now I have that service that I had to think about it. So what does a worldwide spiritual organization do when there's a disaster in Haiti? Let it sink in for a few seconds. And I didn't know what to do. And then the next thing that happened was some people were saying, hey, what are we going to do? And I said, I'm not sure yet. I'll check in with Super Soul and see what we're supposed to do. And then some people started contacting, saying, we want to volunteer. Where do we put our energy and our effort and our time and our resources? So that gave me a clue, because we don't have a temple in Haiti, but we have a temple. The nearest place we have a temple is in Santo Domingo, in the Caribbean area, not so far away. But I didn't know any devotees in Santo Domingo. I knew one devotee, a householder that is a very responsible, mature person. And I contacted that devotee and said, would you be willing to coordinate an international effort of people going to Haiti and doing whatever they can do? And he right away said yes. And so I started communicating with this devotee and sending people to this devotee, and it was awesome. I really didn't have to do too much other than be responsible, because there's lots of our society members that are also responsible. And it turned out somewhere between 35 and 40 devotees just took out a chunk of their time and went to Haiti and did what they could do to help in that situation with a coordinating person, reasonably local. And the support was from all over the world, because we're an international organization. I happened to be attending a meeting in London. So I was in Heathrow Airport and going from one place to another place. And I saw 10 or 12 devotees kind of gathered together in the airport. So I went up and said, Hare Krishna Prabhu, we're going to Haiti. You're the person that I was corresponding with. You're going to Haiti. What's the situation? One of them was from Australia, and he knew how to build houses from next to nothing. And that's what was left, was next to nothing. And somebody else knew how to take seeds and grow agricultural crops very nicely, very effectively, and especially in that tropical climate, it's nice for agriculture, because it's one thing to feed the people, it's another thing to teach them or provide them with the necessities they can grow their own food. And somebody else medical, and somebody else something, and they apparently had done this before. because they seem to know each other. And their plan was to meet at Heathrow Airport and take a flight to Haiti and roll up their sleeves and get to work. Then I asked them, you know, in addition to helping on the physical plane, what's the spiritual plan? They said, of course, we've done this before. When people's lives are broken, then it's not just, they don't just need a roof over their head and something to eat and some medical supplies. They need some spiritual counseling. So we brought extra japa beads and songs in French, because it's French speaking in Haiti, and Bhagavad Gita is in French, and we plan to, for those who want, to give them Krishna consciousness in French. So wow, these people were prepared. And then towards the end, because it was very intense being chairman, it's like a lightning rod in the midst of a storm. You know, it's everything goes to that person, the chairman. So towards the end, I didn't have much time to do, but I was reflecting on it. And then again, like this presentation, I was thinking, I want to communicate. What do spiritual-minded people do when there's a problem? And then towards the end, there was another situation in Chile, not as horrific as in Haiti, but similarly very difficult. And I was grabbing my head saying, what do we do now? So I went through the same thing, found somebody in Chile who wanted, you know, was capable and could coordinate, and some extra people went to Chile. And then my tenure as GBC ended, the chairman, and I was exhausted, so I didn't prepare this. But then this year, the thing in Japan happened, and I thought, I want to speak on this. So that's the background of this topic. And the presentation that I'm going to make do with you this evening is it was intended for college audiences, but at the ISKCON Potomac Temple, Ananda Vrindavan Mataji is the new president, and she requested that I speak like this. So I'm, you know, it's suited for anybody, if anyone that wants to be a little thoughtful. How do you exercise compassion in our contemporary life? So the first slide is a lotus flower. And the reason for selecting the lotus flower is that it is a symbol, or it invokes something, a sense of peace or a sense of nature's beauty or harmony or tranquility. But for me, the lotus flower has another imagery that makes me think of Krishna. And when I've described this to the college students, and Mike's speaking about Krishna, so in the Vedic picture of creation, there are unlimited numbers of universes, not just one. And each of those universes is like a coconut that has a hollow inside, and the inside there's innumerable planets. I mean, some finite number, but so many you can't count them all. And lower, middle, upper planetary systems within that universe. And then there's a covering of the universe. And the covering of the universe has seven layers. Each of those layers is 10 times the dimension of the previous layer, and the first layer is equal to the diameter of the universe. So that sounds interesting, but you do the math. Sariputta Prabhu did the math and said, if you have a little marble or a ball bearing that's like 3/4 of an inch in diameter, the coverings of the universe would expand several miles. The layers of the universe are thick. And then outside of the universe, there's the vastness of the spiritual sky. And in that vastness of the spiritual sky, there's spiritual planets, or Vaikuntha planets. And amongst all of those spiritual Vaikuntha planets, there's one that's largest amongst them and is shaped like a lotus. And that's Goloka Vrindavan. And on the whorl of that lotus, just like you see the lotus in the middle, there is Krishna and Radha and all of the loving associates of Krishna in his realm of Vrindavan, where he's exhibiting very loving and compassionate pastimes. Now Krishna is the source of all compassion. And for the purpose of this presentation, that's what the lotus represents for me. It reminds me of Krishna, the source of all compassion. So I'm going to start with some very simple, straight from the dictionary definitions of what is compassion. And the first of those two definitions is the quality of understanding the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it. So there's three components. One is compassion is a quality. Another is that it has a component of understanding, specifically understanding others' suffering. It goes to others, understanding others. And then the third component is active, wanting to do something to assist that suffering condition. And the second dictionary definition is a deep awareness and sympathy for another's suffering. So, understanding, action, and awareness, and feeling, empathy for another's suffering. So these are the parts. Compassion is a quality, something that's deep within inside you, within the core of your being, and it inspires, it's compelling. Because of that caring, you want to do something. There's a strong urge to act, to help your fellow man or whoever it is that is in that suffering condition. After I made this presentation, the first time that I made this was at Penn State University. And what we had planned was very successful. We invited the Japanese Student Association to participate with us. The reason we did was, at the end, there was a benefit dinner, and whatever proceeds came from the benefit dinner went to the help in Japan. Like, you know, not just talk nice, but do something. And we had connected with the Food for Life Global. That's a devotee organization, but they go all over the world. And I found out exactly what they're doing. They had around 40 devotees. 34 of them had come from Nepal all the way to Japan and from other parts of the world to Japan, and some local Japanese devotees were coordinating. And their main limitation was resources, financial resources, to enable them to do what they were doing. It wasn't just feeding people, it was all these other range of emergency disaster care. So after that Penn State program, one of the attendees forwarded to me a link on YouTube to TED. I'm sure some of the people in this room know what that is. TED is a speakers guild or something like that, where they invite and honor really qualified people to speak, and they have all these rules. You have to, within 20 minutes, you know, present the whole thing. And they have some, you know, very high standards, and it's very powerful speakers that are invited to speak in TED. It's an honor to be a guest speaker at TED. So there was a guest speaker at TED that spoke about compassion, and he happened to be a Google employee, and he happened to be Chinese. And this slide that you see here is taken, well, was reproduced from his 20-minute TED speech, because I find it interesting, not just coincidental, that the three little boxes under compassion exactly match the dictionary definition. But he just, kind of being analytical, broke it down into affective, cognitive, and motivational. There are these three components to compassion. Affective is a feeling. Cognitive is you understand another person and you feel something for that other person, and then you want to do something for that other person. So this TED speaker, I've forgotten his name. I'm not really good with Chinese names anyways. described the corporate culture in Google is based upon compassion, and he explained why. His reason why was that he referred to a book, which maybe some of you know, From Good to Excellent. Sound familiar for some of you? From Good to Excellent. It's a description to a very popular selling book, well, recently. And in a corporate structure, there are leaders that are really good, and there's this, that, and the other qualifications of a good leader. But how does a good leader become excellent? The book describes, summarizing, there's two main things, two main characteristics that make a leader excellent. And what this speaker was saying is both of them are components of compassion. And that may sound contradictory, because leadership sounds like, you know, heroism and valor and chivalry and, you know, out in the front lines and leading. Not like compassionate. It's almost like seemingly contradictory. But good is that leadership capacity that's valorous and chivalrous and fearless and leads the followers into victory at whatever that realm may be, corporate realm included. But the excellent characteristic has these two components. One is humility and the other is ambition. And he breaks it down and says this quality of humility is where the ego is out of the way. And so a leader is not just interested in furthering his career or his own purpose or his own ambitions or his own macho thing. A excellent leader is free from ego, and where they're concerned to go is over here. Compassionately, they understand others' needs, their requirements, not just marketing kind of an idea, but compassionate. And they feel for those needs and requirements of others, and then they're highly motivated to fulfill them. Not from a position of ego, but from the position of compassion. Based on that model, this speaker, TED speaker, he did a much better job than I'm doing, because he did it in 20 minutes and I'm still babbling. He explained that Google, he laughed and said, I'm an engineer, but they've given me the full-time job assignment of writing a curriculum for all Google employees they must take on this, being compassionate, to be effective leaders in their groups. And he brought in one other item, and that's a component to his presentation, and that is emotional intelligence. Have any of you heard that term before? Emotional intelligence. So he's saying that the emotional intelligence is also part of what an effective leader does, and it's part of his curriculum. So if anybody knows a Google employee that knows this Chinese fellow that teaches this curriculum, I'd like to get his curriculum, not for commercial purposes, but for it's strong message. And certainly is appropriate for Krishna consciousness, because devotees are, the natural quality is compassion, as Krishna is compassionate. So how to become excellent Vaishnavas by this main quality of Vaishnava compassion. But he's broken it down so brilliantly. Compassion, his point is that compassion is not only nice, it's, and personally rewarding, it's lucrative. If you're a really, really excellent leader, you can make your organization, corporate or spiritual organization, excellent, and and really succeed by properly applying the principle of compassion. Okay, the next section is, can we do this? Can we just, like, everybody move up a little bit? Because you know how it is. People come in late and it's disruptive in the back. Just do it one time. Come on up. Ooh, come on up. Everybody come up a little bit, little bit, little bit. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So the next section is some quotes on compassion. And I'm going to startle you with the first person I'm going to quote who spoke about compassion. Would you believe that Albert Einstein spoke about compassion? Here's what Albert Einstein said about compassion. And it's very interesting. Our task must be to free ourselves. He's a liberationist. By widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. So, one message here is, if you want to be a creative thinker and an intelligent thinker, maybe even a brilliant thinker, you have to think, as we say these days, out of the box. You have to be able to think other than just the norm. Think widely and broadly. That's freedom. Freedom of thought and freedom of expression. Not just by civil liberties, but by our own freeing ourselves. And he looks to compassion as the component that will accomplish that. And he's turning that, the object of compassion, into wider and wider and wider circles. All living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. Now we know, this is a Prabhupada story, we know that the chanting of Krishna's holy name is the prime benediction for all humanity at large. Yes? Shikshastakam teaches like that. So one god sister of mine, her name is Saradiya, she told me that she once asked Srila Prabhupada, when we're chanting japa, is it all right to think that the chanting of the holy name is beneficial for all living entities and can liberate all living entities? Is it okay to think like that, Srila Prabhupada? And he said, how can you think of all living entities? Krishna can think of all living entities. You think of Krishna. That's our platform of liberation. But in case you can't think of Krishna, you can try to think of all living entities. And become, in a compassionate way, become free. It's a nice concept that there's freedom through compassion. Ultimate freedom through ultimate compassion. And the ultimate compassionate is Krishna. Next quote. You recognize this personality, Dalai Lama. And he says something very interesting about compassion. He probably says many somethings, but this is his most famous one. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. So the part of the embedded message is, compassion is normally thought of as concerned about the happiness of others. And if you want that, be compassionate. But supposing you're not so concerned about the happiness of others, you're concerned about your own happiness, be compassionate, because by being compassionate, it makes you happy. From our lessons of Bhagavad Gita, we understand what that is. It's happiness in the mode of goodness. Correct? From Bhagavad Gita. There's happiness in passion, happiness in ignorance, but there's happiness in goodness. And happiness in goodness, Krishna says, conditions one to a sense of well-being. We all know what that feeling is. If you consciously make some sacrifice, go out of your way to help another person that's in a difficult situation, or even a simple situation, just, you know, helping, like this lady that's having a hard time standing up. So some men think, you do something to help another person. They, you know, bring the cushion so everyone can sit down or something. Just some little service. There's a feeling. What to speak of, you know, other levels of extending yourself for the well-being of others. There's a happiness. It's a mode of goodness happiness, according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, that also binds the performer, seeking that happiness, purposefully wanting that happiness, as the, you know, what's the buzz that keeps you going in the quality of goodness. So we'll get to transcendental happiness in a bit. Here's another statement about compassion. Certainly one would expect Christ to speak about compassion. Here's his statement, one of them. Knowledge and ritual without compassion is empty. We have in our Hare Krishna movement, as does any religion of the world, we have our rituals. Something that I've experienced in the course of being a devotee for a number of years is that many of our temples have long-standing relationships with professors of world religion or Eastern religious study or something, even Bible study courses. They bring their students to our Hare Krishna temple. And one of the things that they want is to see what are our rituals, because in the classroom, the differentiation between this and that religion is in terms of rituals. There's this ritual, there's that ritual, therefore we have different religions. That's not necessarily the fact that that's the basis of difference, but they teach like that. So when they come at the time where we have our deity greeting, because that's a ritual. The curtain opens, we sing songs, and we go to the Vyasasana and have Guru Puja, that's a ritual. And then we sit down and sing Jai Radha Madhava, that's a little ritual, and we have a class, it's a class ritual. And then, you know, they ask questions and take prasadam and go home. So they've learned about the rituals of the Hare Krishna movement when that's their take home. But the ritual, and whatever the religion is, the ritual that's without compassion, just ringing a bell and moving a stick of incense, what's that? It's the feeling that goes into that ritual, or knowledge. All religions have knowledge. But knowledge that has no bhakti or no feeling, no sense of how this is going to be of benefit to the world, to all the conditioned souls of this world, it's empty. That's what Christ was teaching, one of the notions of compassion. Compassion is essence, even in religion. And who is this? Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva, according to the fourth chapter of Canto 1, Srimad Bhagavatam, his whole work of compiling all the Vedas was simply an act of compassion. Because Vyasa is Trikalagya. He is a knower of past, present, and future. So he looked into the future and he saw Kali Yuga. And he thought, yikes, look at Kali Yuga, it's horrible. So there was understanding, there was feeling, and then there was action. He's a literary person, so his action was he took the Vedas that were in a sound vibration form and put them in a written form, knowing that people in the age of Kali would have short memories, they wouldn't be able to remember them, so he had to write it down. And then he divided the forest to make the Vedas into four, to make it more accessible, and explained them through the smritis, and gave the essence of them in Vedanta Sutra, and explained the essence of them in Srimad Bhagavatam, simply out of his compassion. The whole of the Vedic literature is an expression of Vyasadeva's compassion. Here's what he said, one of the things he said about compassion. Great philanthropic souls travel on earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. There's Vyasadeva's sense. It's specific. There's a disconnect between the conditioned souls and the personality of God at its compassion to connect the disconnected from this, their source of emanation, from the personality of Godhead, and to help them understand and be happy with their position as tiny, subordinate parts of the Supreme. And of course, Krishna was very compassionate upon Arjuna, because Arjuna was very bewildered what his duty was. And Krishna helped him by enlightening Arjuna so that he could then understand very clearly what his duty was and the goal and purpose of that duty. Now the quote that I'm going to present is not from Bhagavad Gita, it's from the third canto Bhagavatam. It specifically expresses compassion. Showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self, as well as all universes in me, and myself in you. I consider what he just said. Would you like to be able to see that your own self, as well as all universes, are in Krishna, and that same Krishna, including all the universes and yourself, are in you? That's pretty mystical. How big is you, that all the universes and Krishna and yourself are inside yourself? What does that mean? If you read the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, you'll understand what that means. And to have that realization, Krishna is saying, is the fruit of compassion. How important is compassion in Krishna's teachings? Very, very important. It's a quality that if we want to have to go beyond, just like in a different way, I'm sure, but in a way like Einstein said earlier, one becomes freed from the confines of conditioned material existence and enters into another realm of existence, a transcendental realm of existence. This is from the third canto of Bhagavatam. And Srila Prabhupada spoke about compassion. That is the definition of compassion. One who cannot bear the suffering of others, of another. Great unalloyed devotees of the Lord are compassionate towards the fallen, and therefore they travel all over the world with the mission of bringing souls back home, back to Godhead. Sounds a lot like what Vyasadeva said, coincidentally. No coincidence. Now here's a humorous, entertaining part. Commonly, we think of compassion as one human to another human. Compassionate to another human. There's also compassion towards other species, human to other species. Save the whales, save the extinct species, save the environment. In the suburbs of Chicago, we were looking for some property to have a little temple. And there was this property that was like ideal location, big piece of land, nothing on it, and very low price. So we went to find out, what's the deal here? It's been on the market for a long time. And the reason was, there were some wetlands, and in the wetlands there were some salamanders. And the environmentalists were having this like big deal about the salamanders, save the salamanders. So we walked away like everybody else did, because to save the salamanders prevailed over a Krishna temple or anything else. So aside from human beings to other species, what about other species to other species? Does compassion exist on that platform? So here's some examples. Here's a nice little innocent, relaxed, half asleep pussycat. And there's a little puppy dog that doesn't really know what to make of the pussycat. Maybe she'll pounce on me. Maybe she's friendly. And I'm really tired. And so the puppy dog curls up by the pussy cat and they both fall asleep. I've never seen anything like this before. A little baby monkey cuddled up to a little dove or whatever the bird is. And I never thought of a giraffe as compassionate, but here's a giraffe licking a little squirrel, and the squirrel seems to be very happy taking that gesture of compassion from the giraffe. And here's a mother hen making warm a little baby puppy, even to the neglect of her own little chick sitting by the side saying, "Hey, mother hen, what about me?" Who knows the name of what kind of animal this is?
Meerkat.
Meerkat. So I've seen animals do this where they stand on their hind legs and they're checking out, what's, is there any danger out there? A little cooperation from of the meerkats with the other cat. But it's not always like that. Sometimes it's like this. So we want to avoid that kind of absence of compassion and get on the right platform. So part of the heading is exercising compassion in our contemporary life. Here's some contemporary examples. Anybody here know about Marshall Rosenberg and his work on nonviolent communication? Some are nodding. Some of our devotees have spent some time, won't mention the names, but you know, they really appreciate his work. It's he's based somewhere in Southwest USA, and he conducts extended seminars and has workshops and all kinds of ways of expressing how communication affects others, because compassion is what you do and how it can affect others. And we're all communicating, and there's ways of communicating content that is harsh and it's grating and it hurts the other party, even though the message is right, the way that it's communicated may be hurtful. And then there's ways to communicate the same message in a way that you're concerned about how it's received. Very similar to Bhagavad Gita chapter 18, where Krishna speaks about austerity of speech. Those of you familiar with that passage. Austerity of speech is to speak the truth palatably, because we're not used to the truth, used to, like, you know, something else. But to speak the truth, sometimes people are uncomfortable to hear the truth. So how to speak the truth palatably, that's austerity of speech. Krishna's recommending it, and Marshall Rosenberg, without putting God in the picture directly, is describing nonviolent communication, where you're concerned about how the other person feels when you're giving content. So he uses these little puppets. The one on his right hand is a jackal, and he calls it jackal speak. Then he, like, does this little role play. Jackal says, rah, 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 rah. And, you know, it doesn't feel good. Now, the other is giraffe, and giraffe, maybe giraffe is supposed to be compassionate. We saw another one. The giraffe says very nicely the same message. And if the culture of how we interact with one another as individuals, or we can say collectively as a community of Vaishnavas, how we communicate with one another, where we're concerned about not only the message is truthful, but how it's received by the other party. We can't, like, be obsessive about it, but you can be thoughtful about it. I'd like to give one added scriptural message here that I didn't present in the college. This is our little Bhagavatam segment for the evening. Well, there's one more. In the first canto Bhagavatam, in the seventh chapter of the first canto Bhagavatam, there's a very wonderful description of non-violent action on the part of Arjuna. When, after Ashwatthama, the son of... Who is he the son of? Dronacharya. And Ashwatthama has cut off the heads of the five sleeping sons of Draupadi in the middle of the night when they were asleep. Very nasty. Very vicious, wicked. And when Arjun comes to hear that Ashwatthama has done this, he becomes so angry. He stands before Draupadi and says, when you're performing the funeral for your five sons, I am going to bring before you the head of Ashwatthama. You can stand on his head as you're performing oblations into the funeral pyre. And he went charging after Ashwatthama. And Ashwatthama was fleeing for his life, and many things happened. And he brought Ashwatthama back. And there's Ashwatthama with Arjuna with his sword raised before Draupadi. And Draupadi says, don't do it. And Yudhisthira says, she's right. Don't do it. And he took the vow for Draupadi. Draupadi's now releasing him of that obligation. And his elder brother, who would never disobey, says, she's right, don't do it. Bhima says, kill him. And Krishna says, you should kill him. And here's Arjuna, the dearmost devotee of Krishna, saying, kill him. And don't worry if you're thinking by killing him there'll be the sin of killing a brahmana. His behavior is not brahminical. He's not a brahmana. No sin. Kill him. Like, no obstacle over here. Now, what's Arjuna going to do? Because it's, you know, kill him, don't kill him. And persons who he ultimately reveres and loves and respects and will follow. And they're giving him contradictory instructions. So what does Arjuna do? He thinks of Krishna. That's what we should do when we're in a dilemma. This or that, we don't know what to do. He absorbed his thought upon Krishna, and he then understood what Krishna wanted. So he both killed him and didn't kill him. That is to say, according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, for one who was once honored, dishonor is worse than death. So he cut off with his sharpened sword all of his hair except little patches of hair and sent him out. Get out of here. So he was disgraced, humiliated, a brahmana, but he didn't kill him. But worse than that, he humiliated him, so it was worse than death. And Prabhupada explains what Krishna wanted from this incident was to show, just see how qualified is Arjuna. He knows what my desire is. Even I'm saying this, he knows what my desire is. And he was showing compassion, because that's what Draupadi was doing. She was showing compassion. Draupadi's concern was, I still have my husband's. And Kripi, she has nothing except Ashwatthama. I'm grieving for the loss of my... This is compassion. I'm grieving for the loss of my sons. Why should Kripi grieve for the loss of Ashwatthama? And she has no shelter? That wouldn't be right. I wouldn't want to put Kripi in that position. Compassion is to understand, if I act in a certain way, what will be the consequences? Even if it was the right action, what's going to be the outcome of that right action? Who is going to really suffer? Kripi is the one that's going to suffer. Kripi shouldn't suffer. That's compassion. But some justice needed to be done. Not only, you know, like, so that the world would know justice is done, but for the well-being of Ashwatthama also. See, this heinous act that he had done, unpunished, he'll have to suffer immeasurably. So sometimes you want to be compassionate by being very lenient. And in the case of a Kshatriya, that's not the right position. Right? But how do you... It's very challenging. How do you do the right thing in the right way? Compassion is a key to understanding deeply how to do the right thing in the right way. Another example of... So this is compassion. Nonviolence is a form of compassion. Just as Buddhism teaches nonviolence, compassion. So compassion in speech, or nonviolent speech. That's a modern, contemporary exhibition or presentation of compassion. Here's another. Social activism. Any of our young devotees know about this one, especially. In colleges today, this is really big. Social activism. I'll give three examples. One of them is, a study was done 2 years ago of entering freshmen into college in America, and a separate related study in Europe. And the question was asked of the students, what's going to be the basis of your decision in terms of the career that you're going to develop in the course of being in college? And the answer consistently, like huge percentage of response, was that which is going to make a difference in the quality of life in the world in which we live. Second question, how important is it? How much money you'll make? Answer, that's not what's important. Why? I've seen my parents and older generation, they've got all this stuff. And I see they're not happy. And I see also the quality of their life is not the quality of life that I want. I want to make quality difference. I'm a small person, but I want to make my part in making this world a better place. Big. And here's another example. In many of the college students, particularly young American college students. And I asked them, what are you going to do when you graduate? And their answer is, I'm going to join the Peace Corps for 2 years. Now, many people, as you know, I have to like get myself situated in a good career position so that blah, 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 blah. And that was like, in the last 20, 25 years is security, stability, well-being, you know, all of those important things. And young people today are thinking much more. I was speaking like this in someone's home. It was a Indian family's home. And so I turned to their teenage boys and I said, what do you think about what I just said to your mom and dad? They said, definitely. You know, I said, I appreciate all the comforts and things that mom and dad have given. But, you know, in short, I want social activism. I don't need all these comforts and things. They're nice, I appreciate, but I want to, you know, make a difference. It's a very strong component in the fabric of society, an expression, contemporary expression of social activism, which is compassion. Let me take out a chunk of my life where I'm not getting ahead, I'm just doing something for the benefit of others. Very, very strong contemporary mood today, especially amongst the younger generation. The older generation gets into it too. Now, another section is, how does this, if you want to train or give education, like here at the Seattle Temple, there's a very strong element of educating the youth. Now, how do you go beyond behaviors and train character? Like the character of compassion. So I was discussing this, not specifically compassion, but this concept in a home gathering. And there were maybe 50 people, and like, you know, very participatory group. And right in the middle of this part of the presentation, somebody started convulsing, and I thought they were having like a medical problem. I stopped and said, are you okay? And they started crying. And they said, it's true. I said, well, explain yourself. Get some composure and say what you're feeling is. He said, I've been an educator for 20 years, and in our education system, We recognize we're able to give information, but we're not building character. Look at all these problems that have been, so much violence in the schools and murders and horrible things, and we're not developing character. We need to develop. She like was on a roll, just like invested in it. And we've tried so many things and nothing works. We've tried this plan, that plan, and we can't do it. We can teach behaviors, but we can't teach character. And then she was quiet. I said, do you think it has might have anything to do with separation of church and state? That God's out of the school and now you're trying to develop character? Think it might have something to do with that? There's nothing we can do with separation of church and state. So, those of you that are parents, recognize there is church and state separation, and so if character development is not going to happen in the school. They call it something euphemistic like value education. That's something that's, I've heard that term even around here. But it has to be based on God consciousness. It's just, we'll see as we go along why that is so. How do you train gratitude? Not just, thank you. It's universal. Somebody, a child receives something and the parent's standing by the side of the child. And the child just reaches out and takes the something and the parent says, what do you say? Thank you. Like one of those little toys, you tilt it and you know, it's programmed to make a sound. Thank you. So you can teach a behavior, but how do you teach the feeling of gratitude? That's a challenge. Or respect. How do you teach respect? I'm your parent. How come you're speaking like this? You should respect me. And things like that. And compassion. How do you teach and train that quality? Well, our Vedic culture has an answer. And the answer is, through association of those that have that quality, you can develop that quality. Sangat sanjayate kama. Prabhupada referred to that again and again. Just like if you want to get warm, you stand near a fire. You get warm. You want to develop the quality of compassion, associate with those that have the quality of compassion. That's how. But how to find people who have that quality of compassion? That's another thing. And when that opportunity for association is there, here's two other important elements, and that is that there's some openness of heart, because you can be in the association of a person with wonderful qualities, and if your heart is steel framed, closed, nothing's kind of going to go in. So openness of heart with persons that have nice character, good qualities, then transformation of heart can take place. And something that's necessary for that openness of heart is trust or faith. Krishna speaks about faith in Bhagavad Gita. Without faith, this transcendental knowledge, ninth chapter, most confidential knowledge, it's going to bounce. It won't go in. Mogasha, moga, karmano, moga, jnana, vacheta, saha. You're defeated. Even in good association. So, faith must be there. And one of the ways to help establish that faith is a very essential part of the Vedic model, and that is the teacher-student relationship. I've had it described to me by those that did their undergraduate studies in India and came to America to do their graduate studies, how shocked they were. Of course, this is maybe a decade ago. Maybe it's not so much different anymore. But where there's respect, and then there's the absence of respect. It's shocking. What to speak of explicit disrespect in the classroom between the teacher and the student, or not even just in life, disrespect. So when there's deep and genuine teacher-student relationship, then there's trust. It can grow, trust and faith, and then the openness of heart, and then the qualities can be passed on. That's the Vedic conception. So I'm not going to I have a purpose for this slide, but I'm going to keep going. I want to spend some time now on the Vedic concept, or the Sanskrit term of swabhava. Because the Vedas explain how character is the basis of quality. And in fact, in this TED speaker, one I was referring to earlier, from Google employee, he says the same thing very succinctly in his speech. From character comes behavior. So we're not interested just in modifying behaviors. We're interested in building character. So how do you build character? And this term swabhava is a term that has something to do with, at least on the conditioned platform, character. So let me ask some of the kids in the front row here. What does the phrase SVA, sva, mean? Sva. One's own. Sva. And bhava. What does bhava mean? Huh? Feeling or emotion. Nature. One's own nature. Swabhava. We find that in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita in four verses in a row. Brahma karma swabhava jam. Vaishya karma swabhava jam. Kshatriya karma swabhava jam. Shudra karma swabhava jam. And then from swabhava comes behaviors. Right in Bhagavad Gita. Just as this TED speaker said, it's universal understanding. So what's swabhava? This is for our Western audience that doesn't know the term. And a little picture. There's a soul at the center, covered by the coverings of the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and false ego in the gross body. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. At the center is the soul, and there's coverings of the soul. And what's acting upon both the gross and subtle coverings is the modes of nature. This is the mode of goodness. But it's not only the mode of goodness that's conditioning, acting upon the gross and subtle body. There's passion and there's ignorance that are influencing, impelling action. And according to that, that how we associate with the modes of nature, that constitutes swabhava, our conditioned nature. And then from those swabhavas come behaviors. So here's a Vedic, another answer besides association to develop character is develop the quality of goodness. Because compassion is a quality of goodness, so frame your life in the quality of goodness. And what are the symptoms of goodness? Clean. Kids, clean your room. Moms always tell that to their kids. Can you clean your room? So, cleanliness, truthfulness, compassion, honesty, cultivation of knowledge, regulation in your activity, the foods that you eat, there's foods in the quality of goodness, recreation, discretionary time in the quality of goodness, happiness in the mode of goodness. Bhagavad Gita is filled with so many different examples of how you can frame your life in the quality of goodness. Simplicity. Don't have clutter all over the place. Keep things very simple and clean. Suchi. Quality of goodness. And if you frame your life in the quality of goodness, that quality of compassion will naturally come. And when the quality of compassion comes, then there's the behaviors based upon this swabhava. But it's not always that the mode of goodness is acting. Sometimes the other modes of nature are competing for supremacy. So one has to have a sustained effort of acting in the quality of goodness and framing your life in goodness. So good association, saintly association, and this quality of goodness. These are two Vedic answers of how to train character. And as compassion is a trait of the mode of goodness, there's a very nice description of this in the Srimad Bhagavatam, another Bhagavatam lesson here, of who is this person? Marj Nimi. Is that right? Marj Nimi. Ranti Dev, excuse me. Ranti Dev. Ranti Dev. So Ranti Dev was a very great king and a very charitable, magnanimous king. He was very capable of ruling and protecting his subjects, but he was also always wanting the welfare of his subjects. So one of the ways that he was seeking the welfare of his subjects was to undergo some austerity, for which there would be some fruit of that austerity, some piety accruing to him, and his intention was he would distribute that piety to his citizens. Not just build his treasury, but give the fruit of his piety. Ambarish Maharaj did the same thing. He gifted all of the fruits of his pious deeds to Durvas Muni, so that those pious deeds would protect him from Sudarshan Chakra. So Ranti Dev had that intention. So he decided that he would undergo a 100-day fast. Think about that a little bit. We fast for Janmashtami. That's nice. And by the end of the day, you're feeling a little weak, but you know, it's nice because it's purifying. It's Janmashtami, and then you break the fast, and it's over. Imagine if you extended it to 2 days, 3 days, a week. 100 days is inconceivable. We'd be goners by that time. But Ranti Dev had that capacity for 100-day fast. And on the next morning, he was to break the fast. The royal kitchen made a royal feast and sat him on a royal seat and prepared the royal meal. And just as he was about to break the fast, a brahmana came into the royal palace. Very humble brahmana, requesting from the king something to eat. The king was very happy. He got off his royal throne, paid his respects to the brahmana, sat the brahmana on his throne, said, "This is such a great honor. You break the fast first, and then I'll take the remnants, whatever is left. Such a great honor that you've come just exactly at this time." So the brahmana, being honored in that way, he ate half and left the other half for the king. So the king sat down, ready to eat the other half, and just as he was about to eat the other half, in came a citizen who had many small puppies and said, "My puppies are very hungry. Is there something for them to eat?" He said, "Yes. Here, you take this right off my royal plate. Here's for the puppies." But there was still some water left. So then he was going to drink from the water. And just as he was about to drink from the water, a very poor man came and said, "I'm thirsty. Is there something to drink?" And the king said, "What a great honor. If in this human form of life we can take up activities for the benefit and welfare of others, what more could one ask for in life? My dear sir, please take. I'm so happy to have this opportunity to serve others." And the man drank the water. And then those three personalities disclosed their actual identity, as you see from the painting. One of them was Lord Shiva, another was Lord Brahma, another was Lord Indra, and they were just assuming these roles to test what is the extent of magnanimity, because everybody has their breaking point. But King Ranti Dev didn't have a breaking point. It was like that was his life, was serving others. Whatever he had was for the benefit of others. And they gave him this benediction that you have this quality to such a degree. May you attain the ultimate destination of life for this wonderful capacity of great, great kindness, magnanimity, and compassion. And this is Mother's Day, so we'll honor Mother Teresa. She certainly is a contemporary example of great compassion, known throughout the world, for not for her wealth or her vast learning or some other, you know, being a big political figure, not a Bollywood star, but compassion. World known for her capacity for compassion. But compassion isn't just upon the innocent others. In some cases, like Maharaj Parikshit here, he's showing compassion upon the bull who has had his legs broken by this club in the hand of the personality of Kali. And he was prepared to chop off the head, immediately finish this offender for the purpose of protection. So protection from a kshatriya can also be an act of compassion. Doesn't mean we go around with a chopper in our hand and go chopping people that do hurtful things. But if you're a kshatriya by your duty and extending protection to others may also be an act of compassion. It's a very delicate matter to try to administer protection and compassion from that position, but that's also their duty. They have to have a great qualification to know how to exercise that. Two other points and we're done. Can compassion be misplaced? Because I gave a whole Sunday presentation at one temple just on this point and expanded it, particularly in relation to the story of Bharat Maharaj. I'm going to mention it briefly. But for those of us that are trying to become spiritually elevated a little bit, something happens when that little spiritual elevation comes. Compassion comes, and where to direct it is very important. Prabhupada taught us this lesson of the drowning man. If you rescue the coat of a drowning man, but the man that's drowning continues to drown, no good. There's something missing there. This little anecdotal. One time in our New York temple, instead of having a skit, what they did was a live drama. The sannyasi sat in the Vyasa-san, was giving the class, Jai Radha Madhava, giving the class. And one devotee, a brahmachari in the back, it was planned. None of us knew it except those two. It's kind of an eccentric person. You know, there are some people like that sometimes. He was eccentric. All of a sudden, in the middle of the class, he started calling out, "Help! Help!" Like really loud. The class stopped. Everyone turned and looked, and what's going on? It kept calling, "Help! Help!" And, you know, the speaker got out of the seat, went over, and, you know, it was planned this way. And he took his chatra and brought it back and sat down in Vyasa-san. And everyone's like, he got everybody's attention and said, "So, similarly, what have we done here? We've saved the chatter of the brahmachari over there, but, you know, we neglected him. And if you take care of the garment of the drowning man, but the man drowns, what have you done?" So we may do something that's an act of compassion for the covering of the soul, but what about the soul within? Compassion needs to be directed to the soul within. Even you're doing something in relation to the body or the mind or the social circumstance of the individual. Consciousness must go, just like I was describing earlier about the devotees that went to Haiti. They had a very clear plan for spiritual well-being along with building houses and showing people how to grow their food and so on, helping them with medical requirements. Attention needs to go to the soul. Now here's another example of misplaced compassion that is a personal story. When I was growing up, young boy, I grew up in the middle of New York State, near Syracuse in the Finger Lakes region, that part of New York State, little place. And when I was 5 or 6 years old, there was a infestation of locusts. I hope that's the plural of how you say it. Little insects that have these wings and zzz, and they go in thousands and hundreds of thousands and hordes and swarms of them. It was in a cycle of something like 11 years. And I never saw it again because we moved from there. But every 11-year cycle, thousands and thousands, so many that the sky looks like it's night, although it's day. And they come and they land on agricultural fields and they eat everything. You can hear them. And the field's gone. They fly to another field. It's gone. Fly to the trees. All the foliage is gone. It's like, it's scary. So, during that particular summer, my parents made a mistake. They told me, here we have some black flag. It's a poison. And here's like a little bottle and a plunger. And you can go in the garage and spray in the garage and keep the garage free from locusts. So I went, spraying in the garage. Then I saw a cat. I thought, oh, if I spray the cat, then the cat won't have any problem with locusts. So, compassion, good intention. And the next morning, the cat was dead in the garage. And because she licked her body and was poisoned and she was dead. And I was a little boy. I felt terrible. I thought very deeply about it, and I realized, and it stayed with me to this day, good intention isn't good enough. Or compassion can be misplaced. When you're acting or wishing to act compassionately, you have to have proper knowledge. And now, ultimately, knowledge means knowledge on the platform of the soul. By the way, that's not a picture of our cat. It's another cat. But it's an important lesson to learn. And similarly, Arjuna had misplaced compassion upon the body. He got an A for compassion and an F for where to place the compassion, because it's to go upon the soul. And so Krishna instructed him in the science of the soul. Similarly, I'm going to do this quick because of time, but Bharat Maharaj made a similar mistake. He was a great king, so great the whole world was named after him. That's pretty great. You can get a street named after you, maybe an airport named after you, maybe a town named after you, but the whole planet named after you. He was up there. Great king. And during his rule, his spiritual attainment was near perfection. And then after he turned the kingdom over to his sons, he went to the forest. As you see, he's meditating upon Surya Narayan. He was chanting the Gayatri Mantra, worshipping the personality of Godhead by his meditation. And he was in the state of bhava. For those of you that may not know, it's just above, just before the stage of perfection, spiritual perfection. He was seeing the form of the Lord and experiencing trembling of his body, and tears were streaming from his eyes, and an ecstasy, bhava bhakti. Spiritually near perfection. Then one fateful day, early in the morning, he went to the Gandaki River and performed his morning duties and was sitting by the side of the river chanting his mantra, when on the opposite side he saw a deer, a pregnant deer, that was drinking water. And as the deer was drinking water, she was looking this way, that way, you know, the motion of deer. See, is there danger coming? And then took some water and then looked up and looked around and some water. And then suddenly, very startling sound was a loud roar of a tiger. And much louder than that. And she was very fearful. And when she heard that sound, because of her fearful condition, she had a miscarriage. Prabhupada explains in the purport, when a woman is pregnant, she should not be exposed to something very fearful or very traumatic, because that may happen. Miscarriage. That's what happened to the deer. The baby prematurely was born, and at the same time, she jumped into the air and fell right into the river, and the river was moving swiftly, and she washed to the side of the river and crawled into a cave and died. And there's the king watching this happen right before his eyes, early in the morning. And there's the baby deer floating down the river. So he's the king. He's the protector of the citizens. So he went into the river and rescued the baby deer and brought the baby deer to the shore, thinking, it's my duty to protect this deer. And so he became very careful very dutiful, very responsible in his caring for the deer, because he understood, and there's verses, so many verses describing his internal dialogue of, I'm the mother, I'm the father, I'm the friend, I'm the provider, I'm the protector, I'm everything for the deer, because the deer doesn't have anything. And so much he became absorbed in the thought of the deer that he couldn't even do his devotional practices properly. Right in the middle, you're not supposed to stop sacrifices in the middle. He stopped. Is the deer okay? Even what he's doing. Is the deer okay? Oh, my deer. He became deer conscious instead of Krishna conscious. Literally, he stopped his practices. He stopped his contemplation upon the goal, although he was almost at the goal. He rationalized the whole thing too. There's like, you know, 15 verses where he like figures it out, because he was very intelligent. His intelligence was misused, figuring it, I guess it's okay because I would be neglectful if I didn't take care of the deer. And so he stopped his devotional practices. And then one night, the deer disappeared. And he has all this dialogue about, oh, the deer is such an elevated soul, and I'm an offender to the elevated soul. I've offended the elevated soul. Therefore, the soul has left me. But he's so elevated, surely he'll come back. He'll be compassionate upon me, and on and on and on. And the deer didn't come back. All night long, he was up thinking about the deer. And then that morning, he went to look for the deer, and he fell off a cliff. And when he fell off a cliff, he was thinking of the deer. And because he was thinking of the deer at the time of death, he became a deer in his next life. So there's elaborate purports where why this is being presented is explained. What was the mistake? The mistake of Bharat Maharaj wasn't that he acted compassionately towards the deer. Pause. I'll say it again. It wasn't that he was compassionate upon it. It was a proper thing for a king to do, give protection. The mistake was he stopped his spiritual practice. He forgot about the soul. He forgot about the well-being of the soul of himself and the deer in the name of being compassionate. He saved the jacket without saving the drowning man. Well, in this case, it was a deer. That was his mistake. He consciously rationalized neglecting the spiritual platform. And so there were some pretty serious consequences for that. Now the last section is, we spoke about swabhava in terms of the body and the mind and the modes of nature influencing them, and therefore having a certain swabhava. Is there such a thing as a swabhava or nature on the platform of the soul, aside from the body itself, beyond the influence of the modes of nature and that quality of goodness, that nice quality? Is there compassion on the platform of the soul? Hint, the answer is yes. But how do we get there? There's this contemporary school that speaks about self-compassion. And here's one of the proponents of that. Dr. Kristen Neff is one. She's a counselor or therapist of some kind, I don't know. And in the course of administering to others, she found that some persons have difficulty in receiving from others because they're so hard on themselves. They're not able to be self-compassionate. Like, you know, give and give and give and give and give, and so if you're not able to receive, finally you're empty. And some devotees do that. They sacrifice and sacrifice and sacrifice and sacrifice and sacrifice, and without receiving, they're, we have this phrase, burned out. So her idea is, and I've had this experience of having to speak with others in this way, course of my service to devotees, it's necessary to receive from those who are your superiors, receive from those who are your friends, those that are very close to you, and be compassionate upon yourself. If there's some mistake that others make, forgive them. If some mistake you make, forgive yourself. Self-compassion has a place. There may be some idea that it can be misplaced and misused and just become, you know, self-centeredness or narcissism. So how to prevent it from happening like that, self-compassion or receiving compassion, and that's to come to the spiritual platform. So how do you get to the spiritual platform when it comes to compassion? It's very difficult in this age of Kali. It's so turbulent. We've all heard it so many times. It's just a nice picture from Bhagavad Gita. This is the age of quarrel, the age of strife, the age of all things that are good are diminished. So in this diminished age, how are you going to find another compassionate person, or persons that want to become compassionate, persons that want to become elevated to the spiritual platform? It's very, very difficult. So the scriptures recognize, particularly Srimad Bhagavatam recognizes that difficulty in this age of Kali and offers the remedy, the holy name. Now, in presenting this to universal audiences, I use the phrase sacred sounds, because that principle of sacred sounds is within all spiritual teachings. But specific to our tradition is the holy name, the Maha Mantra. One can become free from material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. This is from the section of the Bhagavatam that's describing the age of Kali in the 12th canto. And it works where persons who are in an unfortunate condition are made fortunate simply from the congregational chanting of the holy name. And aside from the congregational chanting of the holy name, there's our solitary discipline of chanting the holy name in a nice, peaceful place like Seattle, Washington. Very peaceful place. Looks like our Japa retreat coming up in June. Nice setting. Nice. Natural setting is nice. Or in your home, make a place where it's a sacred space. And I travel, so you know, making sacred space sometimes has to be just like an internal sacred space. And set yourself every day in that sacred space and chant the holy names of the Lord and encounter the compassionate nature of Krishna and be filled with that compassionate nature of Krishna and repose that compassionate quality that awakens upon the well-being of the soul, yourself, and others who you associate with, guided by the wonderful teachings of Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Any discussion? Points somebody would like to make or questions? Yes. I find it's very simple in the sannyas ashram to do that. But, you know, for mothers, I can understand, you know, the attention going to dependence. Motherhood is, you have to be tuned into your dependence. It's part of motherhood. If you're not, something's wrong. And you'll have a bigger problem later on by not attending to the needs of your dependents. However, when the dependents become regulated enough to recognize that mother is, you know, absorbed in Krishna, you know, do things with your dependents so that they can at least, you know, empathetically or energetically appreciate this is Krishna time. You know, they can save up their problems till after. You know, anyway, when there's maturity enough, then attention can go. Or when you can try to regulate yourself so that when your child is sleeping, that's your Krishna time. You don't have to, like, attend to some little something because they're asleep. And, you know, it may be a compact time, but that's something that devotees have to do. I've learned, I'm not a parent, but I've learned that I have to have very good use of time. Time management is important. And when I'm doing something, like when I'm here discussing this, you know, I'm here, I'm not thinking something else. When I'm chanting, I'm chanting. That's my time with Krishna. When I'm with an individual that has some need, I'm not thinking of all the other 10,000 things I've got to do. I'm thinking, you know, be present. So there's a necessity in life, in spiritual life, but in life in general, of being present with that which is important. And the practice of attentiveness to the holy name is you'll find, will help you be sufficiently attentive to your dependents when you're with your dependents and not have your mind on some of the other things that you're not doing because you're with your dependents. And there, in other words, there's satisfaction on a personal level for your dependents, and so you can take care of the other things when you're taking, you know, this time to take care of those other things. I'll say the same thing in another way. Besides time management, from spiritual well-being, material well-being follows like a shadow. The shadow follows the object. As the object moves, the shadow moves. So the well-being of your dependents is a reflection of your spiritual well-being. So your attending to your spiritual well-being is going to directly affect the well-being of your dependents. And it's true. Their contentment, their calmness, their satisfaction, and so on. Now, as far as the eating thing, that's just controlling the senses. And if there's no control of the senses, there's not going to be control of the mind. If not control of the mind, where's their happiness? It's directly scriptural. So, when you're chanting, you're chanting. It's not eating or meditating on eating. You're chanting. And there's a time for eating. Just like, that's going to happen later. Just tell your mind, that's going to happen later. At a regulated time. That's the quality of goodness. So if you yield to the pushing of passion, you're making it easier the next time to do that. Just, you know, regulate. That's the quality of goodness. And happiness in the mode of goodness, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning, seems to be like poison. And the end is like nectar. Because the nectar is, by regulation, I can be present with each of the things that I'm doing as I'm doing them. When I'm cooking and eating, it's an act of devotion for Krishna. I'm present. When I'm with my children, I'm present. Like that. And when I'm with Krishna, I'm with Krishna. Chanting Krishna's holy name. The quality of goodness will help you chant the holy name properly. And regulation. Don't go with the other thing. Time management. It's regulation. Those things that you need to do, you set time to do them. The difficulty with motherhood is children are unregulated. You have to respond to their needs. Regulated or unregulated, you have to respond to their needs. You can't tell them, I'm sorry, it's not time to cry. You come back in half an hour, you can cry, it's okay. You tend to their needs. So that's part of the sacrifice of motherhood, the irregulation. But as regulation can come, you're there, ready to do it. Strive like that, at least. Anything else? Yes. Hare Krishna.
In the beginning of the presentation, there was this part about leadership.
Yeah.
And you were my question is not about leadership, but I'm just referring to part of what you mentioned there. And it was about understanding people and their needs and what they are going through.
Yeah.
And I guess it kind of relates to being charitable in our opinions.
Yes. Sure. Sure. Yes.
I want to do that, but sometimes what blocks me, or most of the time what blocks me, is self-preservation also. But I don't want to be harmed if I become so. I'm a little confused in that space about being compassionate and taking care of my needs. So I'm just trying to understand, how can I grow out of that?
Incrementally. Because if you act in principle but beyond your capacity, you'll have a bad experience, and that bad experience is going to prevent you from acting compassionately within your capacity. So, measured, incremental. Make little steps in that direction so that you're not... make sure that you're receiving enough so that you're full enough that you can give. That's another way to say the same thing. Sometimes spent in the receiving and sometimes spent in the giving of that which you have received. It's an expression of gratitude for that which you have received. From that place you can give. And it's not, then it doesn't feel like I'm depleted or that I'm vulnerable, because the protection is coming from Krishna. Not only the source of becoming full, but the protection is coming from Krishna. All right? The Bhagavatam classes that we were speaking, the verses in the morning from Lord Brahma wanting protection, the answer to your question is in all that subject matter that we discussed also. How to receive protection when you're in a vulnerable position. You're dealing with the external energy, the material energy, and you're not this pillar of strength. You're limited. You need protection, and there's a way to receive that. We've been discussing that point. Anything else? Okay, I guess it's time for prasadam. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai. Jai.